Labor and Commerce will come to order. It's 3:22 again p.m. on Friday, March 16th. With us, we have Representative Thompson, Sadler, Johnson, Olson, Miller, and Holmes. Speaker Chenault will be coming in later on. So we've got, definitely got a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries. Only things should be turned on are Etch-a-Sketches and iPads on the front counter. But two bills today, continuation of House Bill 218, prescription drug specialty tiers, and House Bill 259, pharmacy audits. And first one up is 218, and I believe Janet Ogden's going to carry the weight on it from Representative Keller's office.
Yes.
Who wanted to be with us but couldn't. Well, I think he did, probably, didn't he?
Well, I gave him the opportunity.
Welcome back, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
All right. Good afternoon, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Janet Ogden. I'm with Representative Keller's office, also the HES Committee aide. Today I will be addressing HB 218 Act prohibiting insurers from using a drug formulary system, specialty tiers, under certain circumstances. If you don't mind, I'll read the sponsor statement, and then I'll be glad to answer questions. So here we go.
And we have to be gentle. I believe this is your first time before this committee.
Well, before this committee. But I understand that most of you are gentlemen, so I appreciate that.
Most of them.
That's right. Thank you, Representative Holmes, gentle lady. So
it's Friday. We're having a
lunch. It is Friday. And thank you so much for letting me present this bill. Specialty medications are used to treat chronic diseases. They continue to be the fastest growing segment of overall drug spend. While traditional drug spend slowed to an increase of only 1.5% in 2008, and I believe that's really up to 16.3% now with the new stats out, specialty drug spends continue to steadily climb, increasing up to 15.4%. House Bill 218 protects patients with critical illness from sudden changes in their drug treatment and therapy protocols, which may unexpectedly deprive the patient from critical therapies due to the inability to pay for the drug or sufficient time to plan for alternative financial or therapeutic strategies. Currently, insurance companies can change their reimbursement policies with only a 30-day notice, often forcing the patient to absorb thousands of dollars of unexpected costs for expensive specialty drug therapy. By extending the notification period, the savings for the patient will be absorbed by the rest of the policyholders on the plan. This may give the patient additional time to explore other options, which may allow for a transition to a more affordable plan with similar therapeutic results. Without these specialty drugs, quality of life deteriorates and long-term health care costs may increase. Additionally, cost savings may be achieved by exploring options like management through specialty pharmacies that use drug utilization monitoring specifically designed for hard-to-manage conditions. So that is what 218 will be covering. What this bill is really doing is extending the notification period from the insurance company to notify the insurer that these drugs will be, if they go from one tier to another tier, they will have to notify them with a 90-day period. And the tiers, with this tier four that we're specifically talking about, insurance used to pay a flat pay for your medication. And when you go to a tier four, it becomes a co-insurance, which means that you pay a percentage of what that drug would cost. So if the drug costs $4,000 retail, you will be paying at least 30%, which is $1,200 out of your pocket. And so we just wanted to bring awareness that this is happening, and this would give people with chronic illnesses the ability to plan ahead for these changes in their therapies. Any questions?
Representative Sadler.
Chairman, I'm just going to blow your mind, and no questions at this point.
Boy, you got off light, Janet.
I did, thank you. I, you know, the other ones, I look like the deer in the headlights.
Don't go away so fast.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I am sitting here going through some of the letters of opposition.
Yes.
And I haven't had an opportunity to really look for letters of support. Can you tell me, what are the sides on this? I mean, where, who's lining up, pro and con? What are the driving forces behind both sides?
Well, we've had some people call that this had happened to them. Brenda Robertson, I believe, will probably be on to testify what happened with her husband, Pete. MS Society is helping us, or helping with this bill, I should say. A lot of these people fall into this category. Specialty drugs often are the injectable drugs. They are expensive to be made, you know, the manufacturer. We're just trying to find a balance here. But the driving force has been for those who've found themselves in this awkward position and do not have the money or, you know, enough time to find an alternative therapy. So, you know, this will affect quite a few people, with people with rheumatoid arthritis, cancer patients, hemophiliacs. The list goes on. If you have a chronic disease and you need an injectable, you're most likely, one of your drugs will probably land on a in a Tier 4 arena.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is this a new thing that is just starting? Have we seen this before, additional tiers?
Well, tiering actually started in 2006 with Medicare. They started tiering their drugs, and then the other insurance companies, from what I understand, reflected that in what they did with their insurance. However, I think Medicare has a cap, whereas private insurers, at this point, there's no cap. You might be able to reach your out-of-pocket deductible, mm-hmm. which is pretty expensive. You know, it could be from anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to $10,000. And I'm sure there's people that can testify what that amount probably is. But that's the impetus of it.
And so we've started seeing this happening in Alaska?
Yes, we have.
And so I think final question for the moment. The language that's used here in Section 3, that the cost-sharing deductibles or co-payment obligations are determined by unique categories or special tiers. And the language in here we think is going to be clear enough to distinguish.
Specialty tiers is a, yeah.
Specialty tiers, that's the sort of term of art.
Yes.
Not being in that
yes.
realm myself. This is a term of art that will be clear and easy for people to understand.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it could be based on not only the drug but on the dollar value of the
the cost of
prescription.
Yes.
Gets you coming both ways. I think we'll open up to public testimony. And is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Pardon me?
I'll just step away and let everyone testify.
She's going to sit in the audience.
Oh, yeah, fine. Late in the week and I'm half deaf.
They have specialty drugs for those.
Yeah.
It's called Tier 4.
Probably Tier 5 for me.
Oh,
no. With that, seeing no one in the room, we will go to the people online, starting with Brenda Robertson. Are you with us, Brenda?
Yes, this is Brenda Robertson. And I am testifying for my husband and I.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for hearing my testimony. I appreciate it. My husband has had this for over 10 years, and he has been taking Copaxone, which is an injection, for 10 years, and it is a drug that helps to slow the progression of multiple sclerosis. Last June, we were surprised to find out that even though we already paid medical insurance, that we would now be asked to pay over $1,000 more per month just for his daily injections.
Brenda, are you on a, cell phone by chance?
Yes.
You're breaking up. Do you have access to a landline?
Would you like for me to call back on a landline?
Yeah, we're losing about half of the words.
Well, I don't want that.
I thought so. And we'll just take a brief and ease until you call back. And I believe Brenda is back with us.
Well done.
Are you with us, Brenda?
Yes, I'm so sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. You're coming in much better now.
Okay. Basically, a little history. Last June, the specialty pharmacy called my husband to say that before they shipped his medication, they wanted to let him know that his copay had gone up. And we had been paying $30 a month copay. He expected them to say it had gone up maybe $20 a month, and they told him that it would be over $1,000. And so the first thing that he said to me was, I have to stop taking my medication. We really felt like we had done all the right things. We paid our insurance premiums faithfully every month so we wouldn't have to deal with a surprising financial burden, and yet now we found ourselves facing an unbelievable expense. Over the years, we have learned to live with MS and the challenges that it brings to our lives and try to do everything in our power to keep Stephen's body healthy, from taking the medication, researching proper diet and exercise, and making sure that we have health insurance, because we didn't want to ever have to face something we couldn't handle. Since his diagnosis of MS, it has been very important to him to push through the disease and do everything that he can for himself. He still works. He's never asked for or wanted special treatment, but the one thing that he did not expect was to have the opposite happen to him. He did not expect to be singled out and penalized because he was sicker than someone else. While others with the same insurance have affordable choices, he has no choice. He never wanted or expected special assistance, but he certainly expected to be treated the same. And the practice of specialty tiering in itself discriminates against the sickest among us and puts their lives in danger. And I would ask each one of you to imagine your husband or wife, son or daughter, first of all, being diagnosed with such a debilitating disease. I know you would feel, as I do, that it's so unfair because you know you're going to watch the person that you love suffer. But then imagine watching them push through the pain, work every day, try their best to avoid stress, and then be told that the one medication that could keep them functioning is now going to be out of their reach financially. And that is unfair and unconscionable. Raising the amount that we have to pay for a life-saving medication with no generic option or alternative by over several thousand percent with no notice, everybody that hears this story, I think, should be outraged. This committee represents my husband, my family, and other thousands of Alaskans who are in danger. The insurance companies will tell you that they need to save money, and I sympathize with them, and I'm sure that they do. But I don't believe that this is the way. Realizing their savings on the backs of the most vulnerable Alaskans, the sickest, the weakest, and yet generally the ones that are still getting up every day, pushing through their hardships, going to work, and contributing to the state economy. There cannot be anything moral or ethical about this, which is why several states have banned the practice altogether of utilizing specialty tiers, and many others are enacting legislation as we speak to ban it or, at a minimum, cap the patient's yearly outlay to a reasonable figure. When many of these Alaskans become disabled because they've stopped taking their medication, lose their jobs, the insurance companies will certainly have saved money. They will no longer have to deal with those chronically ill members in the insurance pool, but the state will. And while it may save money for the insurance companies, I can assure you it will cost much more in the long run for the state of Alaska if this practice continues. Many of us are testifying here today hoping to persuade you to vote yes on requiring a 90-day notification period before changing someone from copay to specialty tier coinsurance, and I hope that you will consider that as a first step to helping those who are sick among us be able to manage their medical expenses. But to me, this is only step one. In 90 days, there is still no generic drug, there's still no alternative, and there's still no choice. And my hope is that my testimony will shed a light on this issue, and that down the road we can do even more to protect those with chronic diseases from being further victimized, and would encourage the legislature to look into what some of the other states are doing to protect their chronically ill citizens. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Ms. Robertson? Representative Sadler?
No.
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Freeberg, are you with us?
Yes, this is Jim.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today. And looks like we have you down for questions only, or do you have comments also?
I'm mostly available for questions, but I can have a brief comment as well.
And please state your affiliation, and we'll probably have some questions after you state your affiliation.
Sure. For the record, my name is Jim Freeberg. I'm the Advocacy Director with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Greater Northwest Chapter, which includes Alaska, most of Washington, and Montana. And I want to reiterate the comments made by Brenda and those that will follow, and just say this is an issue that's of great concern to the National Multiple Sclerosis since we're seeing this trend becoming more and more common across the country, and now that we're seeing this in Alaska, we want to encourage the legislature to help us take some steps to, at the very least, increase transparency around the use of specialty tiers and hopefully move towards their complete elimination in the future. So that's it for now.
Yeah, we got some questions. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, when Brenda was talking, she mentioned three different trends, I think, that she said we're seeing. One is the approach taken in this bill, which is to put a notice period in before this can happen. But she also mentioned some states are going to an outright ban on the ability to have specialty tiers, and some states are going on a cap. You were mentioning trends as well. I was wondering if you had any kind of sense across the country how many states are choosing each of those three paths.
I don't have numbers on all of those exactly. I can do some of that research, but the one state that's taken an outright ban is New York. New York was the first state to do this, and there's been another state, I believe it was Vermont, that has a one-year prohibition. And other states are studying this issue and trying to figure out what sort of approach is the right way to move forward. Part of what we're seeing also is that this issue may be addressed through the Essential Health Benefits Package as part of the Affordable Care Act. And so each state, since there's some leeway within that, may have the opportunity to address the issue there. But that's obviously up in the air right now.
So, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like it sounds like we're kind of in the early states are kind of in the early stages of feeling their way through this problem, and some are choosing one path, some are choosing the other, and it's still pretty early. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Jim, what are your other states doing? Washington and Montana.
Well, in Washington, we introduced legislation to prohibit specialty tiers, but with the Affordable Care Act really taking up the bulk of our time down here, the bill didn't move forward, but we are hoping to address it through the Essential Health Benefits Package. In Montana, since their session just meets every other year, we haven't yet taken this issue to the legislature, but we're hoping to do that next year in 2013. And part of this is the growing trend that we're seeing throughout medicine is more and more treatments or more and more conditions are treated by an actual prescription rather than a procedure. And so insurers are somewhat slow to catch up to this, and they realize that their coverage for medical treatments via procedures have been traditionally generous in that medical benefit, they haven't been as generous in the pharmacy benefit. And I think that's just in part because until the last 10 or 15, 20 years, there weren't as many treatments available via prescription. So it's a trend that we'll continue to see as the pharmaceutical company does a better and better job of putting out prescription drugs that treat difficult to deal with conditions like MS.
Representative Sadler.
Remember, Mr. Chair, I said for now.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Freebird. I'm looking at some of the information in our packet reference to this is tiers 4 and 5 are identified as specialty tiers. Can you give me a brief primer what the first three tiers are?
Sure. So the first tier is usually a generic drug tier. And so, you know, your copay may be $5 or $3. Your second tier is a preferred brand name drug. And then your third tier is the non-preferred brand name drug, and that's usually the result of a negotiation between the insurer and the pharmaceutical companies. And those, again, increasing in price. And then when you get to a specialty tier, what we see frequently, instead of a fixed copay, a fixed dollar amount, you have a co-insurance or percentage amount. So tier 3 may be a $30 copay. Tier 4 may be 30% or even 50%. So it's a drastic jump up in price and pushes more and more responsibility for the drug onto the consumer rather than have that risk be borne by the insurer.
So you're saying instead of going from a raw dollar number, it goes to a percentage of the actual retail cost of the drug?
Right, and it really varies from plan to plan. I mean, there's no consistency.
And what's the difference between tier 4 and tier 5?
You know, that's one we're still trying to figure out as we hear about these. We can't stay on top of the changing trends as quickly as we'd like. But I think it's just an increasing co-insurance amount. So again, 30% maybe at tier 4 and then 50% at tier 5. And it's potentially based on either the price of the drug or its relative efficacy compared to other drugs within a similar class.
Okay, and I just wonder what qualifies a tier 4 and 5 as being specialty. I don't know if we try and ban specialty tiers in this legislation, they just change the definition of us. And say, well, obviously,
right.
1, 2, and 3 is a pretty good plan.
Yeah, and that's definitely a risk that's out there. I believe under Medicare, they define specialty drugs as those that cost more than $600.
Okay.
But even then, that doesn't necessarily allow us to fully contain the problem if we just outright ban specialty tiers.
I was going to ask another question. I should have asked Ms. Robertson, but do health care plans offered in Alaska, do they have any kind of backup, secondary fallback insurance guarding against this kind of significant increase in prescription drugs, kind of a rider?
That's not something that I'm aware of. I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, frequently we don't see caps on out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs, again, like you would see within the medical benefit. But I'm not sure to the extent that those are used in Alaska.
The state has a high-risk plan that I believe includes prescription drugs, but it's extremely expensive and it's available for people that can't get into the standard companies for pre-existing conditions primarily. Jim, what, do you think it'd be safe to assume that nobody's moving real fast on this because they're waiting for the Supreme Court to weigh in on the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. There's also just a limited bandwidth, I think, to tackle this issue. I mean, it's so complicated when there's the fact that the insurers are merely the middlemen in what we see as increasing prices charged by pharmaceutical companies. And because these drugs are also somewhat new, we're still trying to get a handle on how to best use these in treatments. And so the treatments are somewhat, I don't want to say inconsistent, but we're still trying to figure out what's the best, most efficient use of these drugs. And that's very difficult, especially for disease like multiple sclerosis. It's so variable from person to person. I can't say about how this is being used to treat, you know, cancer and rheumatoid arthritis. But, you know, unfortunately, what we've seen in New York, we were able to get that bill passed, I think actually because specialty tiers weren't yet in place. And so insurers didn't have to change anything. What we're concerned about is that if we don't do anything, there's going to be more and more specialty tiers, higher and higher charges. And at that point, the cost of doing something is going to be too significant to have an impact. So if we can nip the problem in the bud, so to speak, and stop it before it gets too big of a problem, we think it just would be somewhat easier to deal with. But
Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Johnson.
Thank you. So would I be correct in assuming that, is there any implication that the higher the Tier 4 and Tier 5 are that much more effective than other drugs, or is it just price or coverage stratification or bracketing?
It really varies from condition to condition. I mean, for MS, there are no other drugs. There are only specialty drugs to treat the underlying disease. And, you know, I'm not sure, again, how that relates to rheumatoid arthritis or cancer or hemophilia, but there are just no other options.
So it's not as if there is a Tier 2 drug that addresses MS issues. It's got to be Tier 4 or 5.
Well, it's where the drug is placed on the tier. I mean, you can easily place your MS drugs on Tier 3, but insurers just choose instead to place it on Tier 4 or 5.
So it is more of a price or a coverage issue.
Right, yeah. And, you know, the insurers may tell you that they probably are trying to look at the efficacy when you have different drugs within the same class. I'm just not prepared to speak about that since that's not the case for MS.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How long is New York prohibited their specialty tiers?
Let's see. New York, I believe it was just in 2010 that their ban came into effect.
And what I'm leading up to, Mr. Chairman, do we have any idea? I mean, this additional cost, if the copay stay low, the additional cost is going to be a shared cost and spread among all of the people insured under the program. Do we have any idea of what keeping the no special tiers, how much of an increase, are there any studies on how much of an increase that's going to cost the average member of a insured group?
So there was a study in California that tried to answer this question, and I believe it was referenced in the summary prepared by committee staff.
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to look.
Follow
up or?
No, I would like that information. And I guess my point is, someone's going to bear the cost. And I just want to know what that's going to cost the average consumer. And if that's been studied or looked at, and maybe we're too new to even know what those numbers are. And it may be minimal, and I would think the size of the program would mitigate some of those. And so the smaller programs would be more affected than the larger.
I think the 900-pound gorilla is the Supreme Court
case.
And until that's settled and we know what rules we're going to be operating under, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to get any numbers out of the state on projections, at least on the plans that they have.
Yeah. Point taken. Thank you, Mr.
Control over. But any further questions for Mr. Freeburg? Thanks again, Jim.
Sure.
Sheila Talman, Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yes, thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Olson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Sheila Talman, the Manager of Legislative Affairs with Samara Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 218 in its present form, We have submitted a letter to the committee earlier today that outlines some of our concerns with respect to the bill, as well as we have provided some conceptual amendments that might be considered as part of this discussion. Before I speak specifically to the bill, I just wanted to provide some additional background given all the discussion around specialty drugs. And just a couple of points is that these specialty drugs do make it possible to treat diseases for which there are few available therapies, and they provide new options for patients where treatments already exist. The specialty drugs are a growing trend, one of the fastest growing parts of the overall pharmaceutical benefits. When we look at less than 3% of private health plan members are using specialty pharmaceuticals, but they actually account for 25 to 30% of the total payer medical costs. So this is a significantly growing area impacting costs. And I think employers are starting to recognize, you know, employers have recognized this and are looking for ways to continue to offer pharmaceutical benefits for their employees, but want to find ways of making that more affordable and making the overall coverage and the provision of these benefits something that they can continue to do. So I think the focus really should be spent on trying to encourage pharmaceutical companies to develop generic alternatives to these specialty drugs that might help make it more affordable for a bigger majority of the population. In terms of our plans, we do offer a three-tier or four-tier benefit options for our members. And some of the plans, as just kind of an option, as I understand it for groups, they can offer a backstop so that per prescription there might be an out-of-pocket maximum that might be permitted. But that's something that is optional for the group. So with respect to the current bill, we do understand the importance of transparency and providing consumers accurate information about their benefits and out-of-pocket costs. So Premera currently provides detailed information about our benefits upon application and renewal, and this is both for individual purchasers and for our employer groups. This includes information on cost sharing, deductibles, or copayment terms that are applicable to pharmacy tiers, including a specialty pharmacy tier. And this information is provided at least 30 days before the terms apply. We provide another notice if there are any changes to the plan's formulary. So an example of this might be when a generic drug becomes available, and that might shift an existing brand into a different tier. We do send the impacted member a notice by mail 30 days prior to that change. And then we also notify members by mail 45 days before any changes that might impact their rate. So our concern with this bill is the requirement for a 90-day notice time frame. This will impact our application and renewal cycles to provide information much further in advance of the effective date. And the notice requirement will be duplicative to current processes given the various notices that I've already described, and a new federal health care reform requirement. So this will add costs to the system, and it can also create confusion to our members to receive several notices about their benefits. So just to give you some more detail on the requirement in the Affordable Care Act, starting September 23rd of this year, insurers must provide specific information to our members about their coverage and benefits. So this includes a very specific breakdown for the generic drug tier, the preferred brand drug tier, non-preferred, and specialty tier. And for each of those tiers, we have to provide the specific cost-sharing requirements. And this information will be provided upon application, at renewal, and upon request by the individual. In addition to that information, we also have to provide a mid-year notice to our members. So if there's any change that would impact those four tiers and the cost-sharing requirements that I've described, that triggers a notification out to the member at least 60 days in advance of the change becoming effective. And this requirement will apply to all impacts, to all plans. So that means the grandfathered and the non-grandfathered plans for individual groups and the self-funded plans, and that would include the ERISA plans. So because of these existing notification processes that are already in place, and the new requirement that we are getting ready now for under the federal health care reform law, we oppose a bill that would create yet another notice and add costs to the plan. So thank you, and I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I got the first two. That's, I guess, the power of the chair. You mentioned something that kind of set off bells and whistles. You said the problem could partially be solved by the drug companies developing generic drugs for the specialty conditions. And I've always been under the assumption that generic drugs came about when the patents expired on drugs that had already been brought online. Am I off track, or am I close, or generic drugs are not developed. They are regular drugs after the patent life on the drug expires. And that's why we see things like Ambien might have a molecule or two changed, or other drugs to make a new one that where the Ambien would be available as generic, but Super Ambien or whatever new one is slightly off would be good for a few years under a patent, but I don't think you can develop specialty drugs.
Well, I believe you are correct, and so it would be working towards reducing the number of years that a patent can remain in force so that it would encourage potential generic alternatives to come into the market faster.
Okay, that was a little different than what you said the first time. But thank you on that. But have you developed any models on the bill in its current version and what the impact would be if we passed it out of committee with no changes on your company for the next 12 months? Just a rough percentage of the increase?
Well, the bill right now would increase the notification requirement from our kind of standard 30 days to the 90 days, and we have not done a cost impact, but that's something that we can try to work on.
So you don't have any idea on what it's going to cost you? Is that what you're...
No. It's more that there will be just multiple notices getting generated and sent out and just keeping track of all that when the market's standard, and what we do in our in Washington and Oregon, as I understand it, is the 30 days.
Well, I mean, playing the devil's advocate, the impact could be 2%, or it could be 10%, or it could be 15%, but we don't know what it is.
Yes. I don't have that information and don't want to just estimate without
talking. Is that something you could get for us in a few days?
Yes, I can certainly try to do that and provide that to you.
Perfect. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. I don't know if I can formulate my... my question properly or not, but to me this looks like, okay, a couple have got insurance that they've been paying for 20 years into, thinking it's going to cover any of their medical costs. They're in their 40s, and one of them gets cancer, and the insurance company ends up paying hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for treatment and operations and things like that. Why does this bill, how much is it going to save the companies if they change those deductibles and charge a bit more? Why is that so important? Because it's no different than a cancer patient. Is this opening the door for in the future you can change the rules on somebody's got cancer and what they're going to be for a copay for that? I don't understand why that this is even being attempted. To me, it doesn't seem fair for the people that are buying insurance thinking that they're going to be able to have their life savings carry them on through the rest of their life, and they have this happen to them, and all of a sudden the deductibles are costing them $1,000 a month or more than what they figured it was going to cost because they've been paying thousands of dollars per month on insurance for 20 years. I just don't understand why that there has to be tiers and that this changes things, and it scares me that what it might do in the future for other type things besides drugs. I didn't have a question. I just kind of had a statement.
Kind of just like the one I asked.
Yeah. I don't know if you wanted to respond to that or not.
I'm having a hard time wrapping my hands around the fact that you're currently doing 45 days, and you the bill calls for taking it up to 90. So basically we're talking about an increase of 45 days, not 60, if you're at least your company's Blue Cross and Blue Shield are already doing 45. So, I mean, I'm having difficulty thinking that it's going to be a significant increase in premium. This shared premium, obviously, but yeah, if you could get that for us sometime next week, it'd be appreciated. It just has to be a ballpark, and it's not anything anybody's going to hold you to, but at least it'll give us an idea on what we're dealing with. Representative Sadler.
It would also be good to know in what form those costs come. My experience with my health insurance and other business relationships is that more and more is going to internet notification and online accounting, saving an awful mm-hmm. lot of I used to get 5 or 6 or 10 EOBs with 45-cent stamps on them every day, and I know that there's some cost of notifications. So if we're doing it by email, it might be less cost. I guess when you break down those costs for the chairman, if you could outline what the nature of those costs were, it would be helpful.
Okay, we will try to do that. One way to look at the cost impact is if the person or the patient would be paying at a rate during the 90-day period versus what they would have been paying during the 30-day period. So now they're at a different rate structure for much longer, then that would drive up some costs.
I'd like to apologize to the committee. I had hoped that we would be able to get Linda Hall today, but we've been unable to reach her, and we thought that we would have her to present the division's perspective. And do we have anybody online from the Division of Insurance? Nope. I apologize. But the bill won't be going anyplace today until we get a few answers. Linda is a tool that we need to utilize on this. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan, I wonder if I could ask you kind of the same general question I asked Mr. Freeberg a little earlier, just a little bit of explanation as to what your company considers the Tier 4 and Tier 5, what differentiation there might be between those two tiers, and again, if that's a differentiation based on efficacy or if it's based solely on coverage conditions or costs.
So for the Tier 4 drugs, these are the specialty drugs that are typically injected and used to treat complex medical conditions. And so they usually require more specific handling and involvement with the physician and potentially special storage. So I think there's kind of a broad guideline along those respects when something falls into a specialty tier. And we are doing some tiering. We're looking at more around efficacy to provide tiers that are more value-based, so looking at the efficacy and the value of the drug and its clinical effectiveness. That would be another way that we're looking to develop tiers to provide a focus on drugs that are providing more value to the patient. So an example of that would be if there's two drugs out on the market, but one is actually providing a better benefit to the member, so extending their life or the number of months for the patient, that would be placed on a lower tier, and so that would be something that we would want the patient, encourage the patient to take, versus the drug that might be on the market that would be less effective compared to that first drug, and that would be placed on a higher tier.
I'm afraid you lost me. I'm trying to, so is a higher tier imply a more effective drug?
Or more?
No, not currently under the three-tier system, under the standard system. And the fourth tier is just a way to identify those drugs that need special handling and storage and more physician assistance and are used to treat more complex conditions.
When I hear the words tier, I think that there is some additional layer of benefit or something that's it's a cumulative improvement. Would it be easier for me to understand if I consider them different categories of drugs?
Yes, because the tier, so it usually starts with a generic and then a non-preferred brand and then a brand drug on top of that.
Because my understanding of tiers is that each subsequent tier encompasses everything previous plus a little bit extra, but it just this is like category A, B, C, D, and E. Are there any, should we look toward a tier 6?
A tier 6?
Yeah.
That might be something that's being reviewed, but I think more in line with what we're looking at is more about providing a value-based benefit structure for our members in which the drugs fall into the various categories based on its efficacy and benefits to the member.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, one last question. So the tiers are not just the handling and storage, but also the value, your claim of the value to the consumer.
Well, that would be what we're developing currently. So it's not out in the marketplace right now, but what we are trying to focus on is categorizing drugs based on their quality, value, and effectiveness, not necessarily the standard generic brand, preferred brand.
But then you just said that...
So each grouping within the value, within a value-based benefit plan design would be based on their value and effectiveness, but you could have within one tier generics or brand name drugs, et cetera. But the focus is much more on providing the effectiveness, looking at the effectiveness.
I'm sorry, I thought you had earlier said that the higher tier did not imply more effective, but now you're saying it does imply more effective, more quality and value. So you have confused me successfully.
I apologize. No, I'm talking right now about something that we are currently developing that is not out of the market.
I'd like the record to reflect that we were joined by Representative Keller right at the beginning of Ms. Talman's testimony, and if the representative would care to join us and add anything, we've opened it up for public testimony, but is there anything you can sit there, or you can join us at the table?
I have a very qualified staff.
There's always a great hazard in walking in late and adding something because it probably has been covered. But this tier system, as I understand it, was devised by Medicare in as a reaction to the high cost of drugs. And they were just trying to work on the copay. If you covered that, I'm sorry. But just an interesting bit of history that I found that the real problem here is that the cost of health care, you know, is screaming high and everybody's terrified. Because it looks like we're heading for a cliff, and I could talk for that on 10 or 15, 20 and a half hours, just keep going. But this was designed by Medicare to manage their payments for the various drugs, and then it was picked up by the private sector. So for what it's worth, I don't understand it as well as I would like, and I really appreciate you all looking at it, so thank you.
Do you care to join us at the table? We've got a couple any further questions for Ms. Talman? Thanks again. We're on a roll, so let's go to Cindy Laubacher, Medco, Roseville, California. You with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Chairman Wilson. This is Cindy Laubacher, Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Medco Health Solutions, and I'm testifying today in regard to our concerns in opposition to House Bill 218. Medco is a parent company to Accredo Health Group. Accredo Health Group is one of the nation's largest and leading specialty pharmacies. Our clients include state employee plans, union trusts, health plans, and who generally manage their prescription drug costs by maintaining a member cost share of approximately 20% to 25% per tier. So that's your generic tier, your tier ones, your tier twos, et cetera. In next year, in 2013, our sponsors are looking at having approximately 1% of their drug spend go to specialty drugs, yet that will represent approximately 20% of their plan costs. So we are sympathetic to and certainly concerned about the cost of prescription drugs and specialty drugs in particular. One of the questions that's come up is with regard to the development of generics around bio. These are typically bio drugs. We're talking about development of bioequivalents. And Medco and Accredo are very active at the federal level lobbying Congress to reduce the patent time on on these very expensive high-end drugs, specifically for the purpose of getting generics or bioequivalents to the market sooner so that we can bring these costs down, because we are very concerned as to the impact this is having on our clients as well as on our clients' patients. Back to the bill, patients typically, as has been noted, receive benefit notices prior to the start of the benefit year, and then if changes occur during the benefit year. And we are very concerned about the confusion that will be created as plans, you know, are required to provide 60 days notice, and then, or provide 90 days notice, and 30 days later provide 60 days notice, and then there could end up being another notice if there's another change. We just think that that's going to create confusion in the marketplace, confusion amongst patients, and for those reasons we are opposed to the bill. We're certainly happy to talk to you about tiers and drug costs and how you can deal with those issues, but this bill isn't going to get to that particular issue. So for those reasons, we're opposed, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused about what I keep hearing about these multiple notifications, because, and this isn't necessarily fair to ask now, because the letter I'm looking at right now is the one from Premera, but it references that, for instance, if the federal law goes into effect, they must be notified at least 60 days prior, and a lot of these things say at least. I mean, why is this triggering multiple notices if all of them are written to provide at least X amount of notice? Couldn't you send out one notice 90 plus days in advance and have it cover all of them?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, as we typically see it, because we often are drawn into this because we're helping the plans manage the benefits, and we're the ones dealing with the more directly with the cost issues and notifying plans when changes occur, and so we just think that you're going to have the 90 day and then the 60 day, and then there's going to be other notices that go out around 45 days for other things. It's just you're sending out a notice about the same thing twice. Now, as to your question, can't we just, you're probably better directed at Premera, but if we're sending it out 90 days in advance, I have to look at the federal law, but I think we'd still be required to work with them to send out a 60-day notice. But I'd have to look more specifically at the language in ACA. But Premier might be better able to answer that question.
And, Mr. Chairman, if that can't be answered today, that's one of those things that I'd want somebody to get back to us. Put on the list for people why it is that we can't figure out a way to have all of these notices be sent out together. That seems like that would make far too much sense.
I've got a question. One of your first comments was 1% of the specialty drugs represent 1% of the, your total drug volume. Is that correct?
For our plans, for any given single plan, say for purposes of discussion, Premera is one of our clients. So for Premera, 1% of their drug spend, 1% of the drugs that are dispensed under their plan are specialty drugs, and yet it will provide for 20% of their prescription drug cost.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. It was not plan cost; it was prescription plan. That wasn't the entire.
Whoever the plan sponsor is,
yeah.
Whether it's the health plan or the state of Alaska or whomever, it's whoever's paying for the prescription drug benefit.
No, thank you. You cleared that up. That was going to be my next question. Sadler. Representative Keller.
Yeah, Cindy, thank you again for calling. Thank you for calling in. I thank you. I think and Hess, and maybe that was Sheila from Premier. I'm not sure. But I really appreciate the fact that you call in. We make sometimes decisions related to who pays without insurance company input, and I appreciate it. The question I have is some of your concern about the bill have to do with worrying about whether or not it will become a mandate for more coverage, you know, so that we start to meddle with, legislatively meddle with how much you have to pay, or is it just the notice?
It's just the notice, because the bill only deals with the notice. The bill isn't going to address the issue raised by the first person testifying regarding the issues around the costs for her, the increased costs for the Copaxone for her husband. So it's not, the bill is only going to deal with the notice requirement. It's not going to deal with, address the costs, and that's what we're trying to do at the federal level by getting the, you know, convincing the federal government, the Congress, to reduce that patent protection so that we can get generics to the market. That's what will help keep the cost down for patients and for our plan sponsors. But this bill won't address that.
That gives me some comfort, actually, because I just have a really hard time seeing that the notification is a huge deal, but I've always been uneasy with the thought that when we get into mandates and we start increasing the things that you have to cover. So thank you.
Well, Cindy, again, if we have the Division of Insurance online, I may be putting my foot in my mouth, but I believe we have certain personal lines coverages where they can change the rate 90 days before the renewal, and they can do basically anything they want as long as they give 90 days notice prior to the renewal, and that becomes the contract for the next 12 months. I don't know if we have anything in Alaska on the life and health and benefits side that would be similar, but I think we do have presidents on the property casualty side.
I don't know.
And if you were able to set it and have it good for a year, you obviously probably wouldn't be happy with that, even with 90 days.
Well, we generally find that for our plan sponsors, it's been our experience that changes occur at the front, at the beginning of the plan year. So prior to the start of the new plan year, 30, depending on what the state law is, 30, 45, 60 days, the patients are provided with information with regard to what the new benefit will be, what their costs and co-shares, co-payments will be, et cetera. So any changes in the benefit typically happen at the front, prior to the start of the benefit year. Patients are given notice of that, and then the plan year starts. It's very uncommon. It's extraordinarily rare. Well, I shouldn't say it's extraordinarily rare, but it's rare for changes in copays and insurance to occur during the plan year or mid-year, and especially, I did check with my folks because I did hear this testimony yesterday, and they said that it's extraordinarily rare to see a rate increase mid plan year, as has been described, where it went from, I believe, and I may have this a little bit wrong, but $100 a month to $1,000 a month. We don't typically, most of our plan sponsors will cap coinsurance. If they move from a copay that most of you are familiar with in Tier 1, Tier 2 for generic, you may be paying $10 a month for a brand. You may be paying $20 a month. And then when you get to Tier 4, you're typically paying a percentage, and that's maybe 20-25%. What will happen is when plan years change, the plan will typically move to if they go to a coinsurance, if they move from a flat copay of, you know, $100 to a coinsurance of 20%, they'll do that with a cap of, say, $200. So that's typically what we see. So the example we heard earlier, I really, quite frankly, surprised me, and I went back to my folks to ask how, if that happens, and they said that it's extraordinarily rare.
Would it be safe to assume that the majority of the people that you're dealing with are covered by group plans rather than individual, or is it both? Or
That would be true. I apologize, Chairman. Yes, that would be true. We deal only with group. We do not deal with individual coverage. And that may be, would have been one of my questions, but it sounds like that she and her husband may be under an individual policy.
And would it be also safe to assume that probably 75 or 80% of your plans come up on January 1st or July 1st?
Yes.
So it would be relatively, I mean, you could, from that standpoint, you would basically have 2 days of the year that you would have to be worried about to pick up most of the people. It would just be the individual plans, possibly, that have the exposure to not having a time certain date of the calendar year or the fiscal year.
That would be true, yes.
Well, as I said a while ago, we're not going to be moving the bill today, but I hope that you're available the next time that we meet on this bill. And I think I got a lot of answers from you, Representative Sadler.
I do have one more question, Mr. Sheriff, if I could, before we wrap up. Ms. Longbike, where did the impetus toward coinsurance come from? I've had the chance to read some of the more background information, and the question that comes to me is, was this pressure coming from your reinsurers? Is this something from your finance departments? Or were you just following the Medicare lead? Why did you start doing coinsurance when you did?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I will get an answer to that. I can, generally speaking, just based on my years working in health insurance and generally working for Medco, as I understand it, in talking to my formulary folks, coinsurance is just a tool that is used as an option to clients. Not all clients use coinsurance. Some do. Some choose flat copays. And it's simply a tool available to our clients to assist them in managing their costs. And that's really what it's just around finding an option or an alternative to help them manage their prescription drug costs. The specialty, and it's typically only. You typically only find it at the Tier 4 level for specialty drugs because of the high costs associated with specialty drugs and the care around specialty drugs.
So, the precipitating factor was that you offering it as a cost savings or them demanding it?
It may be both. I apologize. I can't answer that question. But typically, we respond to the market. So my guess would be that, and I will go back and get an answer to this. I don't want to provide you necessarily with a guess. But, what typically happens is our clients come to us and say, our costs are skyrocketing. What can you do to help us? What are other options that we that are available? And we present them.
Okay,
and this would be one that we would present.
I think I can help on that one, to make sure everybody has skin in the game and that it's not overutilized. If something is free, or it might be overutilized, but if you're paying for a portion of it, you do have some skin in the game.
Can I ask one question?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Cynthia, I appreciate it. You said that specialty drugs represents 1% of the, total prescriptions filled. Can you give me a number on that? Can you tell me, is that 10 people? Is that 10,000 people? Is that a million people?
Number of patients served through specialty? I can get you an answer to that. I don't know. Specialty drugs are it's a small market. There's not, there are a small number of people who have hemophilia, and then you have MS and rheumatoid arthritis, and it's based on all these different categories. So I don't know that there's a specific number of patients that are covered by specialty. It's just primarily around what all the high costs of the particular drugs. You may have a plan that has a high number of hemophiliacs and a very low number of other persons with other types of conditions. So it really sort of varies by plan.
And if I could, I guess what I'm trying to get to is just how many notices would you have to send out?
The notices have to go to, I apologize, through the chair, the notices have to go to everyone. The notices don't just go to the five patients who may have hemophilia and the four patients who may have MS. The notices are required anytime there's a change. The notices are required to be sent to every member, every plan member.
Follow.
And so HB 218 says you've got to send that notice to every member?
Correct.
Not just the ones using specialty drugs?
Correct.
That's a considerably bigger number than 1%. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Cindy, there used to be a type of drug called orphan drugs. Is that what we're now calling specialty drugs?
I believe those are, I believe those are, that is correct.
Any further questions? Thanks again for joining us today. Let's see. Barbara Jones, Anchorage. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good afternoon, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barbara Jones, and I am testifying for myself. My daughter was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is now called juvenile idiopathic arthritis, when she was about 12 years old. She started taking a cocktail of drugs. She was hospitalized about 2 to 4 times a year. She had to quit doing sports, and she actually quit going to school full-time, and she only went to high school part-time. Then, about 2 years ago, she started on a specialty drug. It costs $400 a week or $1,600 a month, which actually has been a miracle to our family. Fortunately, my husband and I are both employed and have insurance. He has been on his job 26 years, so he's been putting funds into the kitty long before she was born. And I've been at my employer for about 13 years. Right now, our daughter is doing very well. She graduated from high school on time. She's in her first year at UAA and has been accepted into the Honors College. She's declared a chemistry major and wants to study medicine. She's on spring break, and today she sent me a text that she went on a tour of a research hospital. She's going to be receiving a Spirit of Youth Award next weekend for her work with other children with arthritis at Arthritis Foundation camps. This bill promises 90 days notice. We won't be confused by multiple notices. We need this bill as a start to help my daughter and all the others who need these drugs remain productive and contributing members of our state and our community. Thank you very much for your support of this bill.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Any questions for Mr. Jones? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Jones, how many notices do you get in a given time period called a year for prescription medication coverage for your daughter or just health insurance in general? What would you think, what would be a confusing number of notices to get about health insurance coverage?
Well, did you know, I don't think there would be a confusing number of notices. You know, we get phone calls from our specialty pharmacy almost every week. And, you know, they're not confusing. You know, I will admit, in our family, we have a little division of labor, and this is my husband's end of the log. But I do hear the telephone messages. I do see the mail that comes in, and it is not confusing to us.
Thank you.
Thanks again. We have Barry Christensen online. He says for questions, but I think we might be able to get some comments out of him. Barry's the with the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Are you with us, Barry?
I am, and actually, I was just waiting on the line for HB 259, but I'd be glad to offer.
Oh, I had down for 218 also.
There's been some confusion. I got dropped a couple times from the line. There were some techno problems today.
Oh. Has the association taken a position on 218?
We have not.
What impact do you see as a pharmacist?
Well, I think this is, mostly a notification rule. I guess some as a pharmacist, I know sometimes we get caught in the, when the patient comes and says, hey, guess what, I'm going to have to be dropped off this medication because I can't afford it anymore. So we get involved in that sense. As been mentioned, a lot of the specialty drugs now are distributed through specialty pharmacies. That's another element. But I think there's a lot of pharmacies that do in Alaska, though, that do dispense specialty drugs. And certainly it's a concern to us because it's a concern to our patients. But like I said, the association hasn't taken a particular stand on this legislation.
Specialty pharmacies is a new phrase to me. I mean, today's the first day I've heard it, actually. I'm assuming that's either internet or mail, or how do they operate? Are there a lot of them, or am I the only one that's new to?
There are regional specialty pharmacies. I do not believe that we have one in the state, so I think most of the medications that are coming in, most of these specialty drugs, a lot of them anyway, are refrigerated items, so they'll have to be refrigerated in with a refrigerant to the patient, which in some areas is problematic in Alaska, as you can imagine. There are a number of different specialty pharmacies across the United States.
Do they break it down by condition or by drug? I mean, do they handle like one drug or just one?
I think most specialty pharmacies actually do a variety of different specialty drugs. They contract directly with the manufacturer on certain drugs. There would be some specific specialty pharmacies that just deal probably with one or two specialty drugs, but I think the majority of them do a number of different specialty drugs.
So who regulates them, the state they're in or the FDA, obviously? Probably both? I guess that's...
Yeah, both. It would be the states they're located in. And in terms of the FDA mostly has to do with the regulation of the manufacturer of the drug. They would probably only get involved if there was some issue in terms of transporting the drug.
Representative Sadler.
Chair, this is for you. Actually, I've got to be honest, I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding each word you're saying, so the general overall message of what you're saying is evading me. I don't know if you're on a hands-free mic or hands-free phone, but if you do have a handset to pick up, it'd be helpful. It sounds like good information. I'm just missing it. I'm sorry.
I just did that. I'm sorry. I wasn't prepared to
Much better.
Actually get on the line yet.
You want to say that all again, then?
Any further questions? Thanks again.
Yeah, and I'll have
to... Probably talk to you later on or next week.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Antonia Fowler, Anchorage.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Okay, my name's Antonia Fifeless Fowler. I'm the director of the Alaska MS Center here in Anchorage. And in conjunction with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society Greater Northwest Chapter, I'd like to express my support for House Bill 218. And though this bill, as you proposes only a simple change in the requirement of 90 versus 30-day notice to the patient, it would result in a major benefit of decreased stress and increased time to pursue alternatives and other options for continuing therapy if people find themselves unable to afford the increased out-of-pocket copay imposed upon them so unexpectedly. Unfortunately, the stress created by unpredictable circumstances and increased financial obligations, sometimes as much as $1,000 per month, as you've heard, can translate to worsening symptoms for people with MS, which then translates to the inability to continue working and functioning at home or in the workplace. A recent survey that we did of Alaskans living with MS showed that due to high prescription drug costs and high copays, 41% have experienced financial strain, changed their treatment plan, skipped medications, modified their dosage, or stopped treatment altogether due to inability to pay. And this is exactly what we want to avoid. We want people to continue to have access to these medications at a reasonable rate because there are no genetic alternatives. And if people lose access to these life-altering drugs, we're regressing 30 years and going back to the time when I was first diagnosed and there were no drugs even available to treat MS. At that time, young people, you know, in the prime of their lives were pretty much told to just go home and wait for the inevitable. We were unable to work, considered totally disabled, put on Medicare, and talk about being embarrassed, being putting on a burden on the society and have the cost of care for these people who could have worked being put on the state. It was a pretty embarrassing situation. There still is no cure for MS, but these medications developed over the last 20 years slow the progress of the disease, and they help keep everyone much more functional than they would have been without. And as you know now from other testimonies, you know, it's not just people with MS who this affects. It's a large group of Alaskans. And there are over 1,000 Alaskans with MS. I don't know about hemophilia, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, and lupus, but it gets to be a pretty big number for our state. Without House Bill 218 and eventually stronger legislation governing this specialty tiering, the most chronically ill Alaskans will continue to shoulder an unequitable burden of cost for their medication drugs than that which applies for non-preferred brand name drugs. Therefore, as someone who lives with MS and the challenges of MS and the high cost of prescription drugs, and someone who's lived and worked with individuals in this community for the past 30 years, I would ask you all to eventually consider following in New York's footsteps and ban specialty tiers altogether on the grounds that they are discriminatory against people with chronic conditions. But for now, I want to encourage you to vote for House Bill 218, which sends the message that an increase in copay by 25 to 30% of the cost of the drug without significant notification, which I too find not to be confusing to have more than one notification, is unfair and detrimental to the individuals involved. I truly appreciate your attention to this issue and all the questions that have been asked. And just want to add that MS is life-altering enough, as are all these diseases. So let's not take away the tools that help us live more fully every day. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I can tell you one thing. I don't think you'll see us do anything that's further than the bills that are in front of us from the standpoint that we have to wait and see what the Supreme Court is going to come in with the Affordable Care Act, because in fact I think virtually all states are pretty much on hold until they find out what the new rules are going to be. But again, we appreciate you calling in and testifying and taking the time to spend part of your afternoon with us.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your attention to this.
And we have nobody else online. We're going to hold the testimony open, and we're going to be getting additional information from at least two of the companies. And Representative Keller has a comment.
I just want to say thanks. And it's real. The pharmaceuticals are getting better and better, and they typify the problem we have ahead of us. As they get better and better, can we afford them is the question. And forgive me, but a recent ICER study this summer, if you want it, I can get it to you, showed that the total spending for health care in Alaska was $7.5 billion. That's half of all earnings of all Alaskans. You know, and you think about that a little bit, and it's really kind of confusing because we know that, you know, and we take a poll in the room, it isn't half, you know, but that's how much it was spent in Alaska in 2010. A lot of that is money coming in from the federal government. So it's a very sobering, because this scale, the rate of increase, is supposed to double within 9 years. You know, I don't know how in the world, you know, we have to deal with this stuff. We're going to see more and more of it. And, you know, pharmaceuticals are great. And there's more and more of us getting older, you know, so the cost, that's part of the reason for the cost increase. So I'm comforted that this committee is also looking at that issue. Thank you for sharing our pain. And I know you'll do the right thing, and I think, you know, I really appreciate it if you'd move this bill just to, you know, if nothing else, continue to keep everybody aware of the crisis ahead.
I think to move it, we're going to need some more information, yeah. And I think that'll be valuable to
absolutely
as it works its way through the process. And with that, I'm going to hold the bill over, and we're going to take a brief at ease and set up for the next one. We're back on the record. The next bill before us is the continuation of House Bill 259. And we where we left off was with public testimony when we heard this bill last time. And we've got a few people signed up. We're going to see if we can get through the rest of the public testimony today. Rose Calamirdes, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
It sounds like a good Greek name.
yeah, it's Calamirdes.
Calamirdes. Well, I'm Greek on my mom's side. I have a problem with language.
That's okay.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My name is Rose Calamirdes. I'm the administrator of the Alaska Teamster Trust Funds, and I'm here to testify today on House Bill 259, which the Teamsters and the Teamster Trust Funds oppose. I've read through the bill. It's not well defined, and I think it's going to be a confusing bill for the state, and which would have to administer it. Plans such as ours hire a pharmacy benefit manager, the PBM, and they provide all the pharmacy services to our members, and they help us control pharmacy costs. Part of the role of the pharmacy benefit manager is to audit the claims for our members. This bill clearly goes to protect the pharmacies, but does little for the consumer, our member, who is the payer. This is not a revenue-neutral bill because it will put an onus on the state to administer the relationship between the parties. And it's duplicitous. The bill is poorly written, and our position is that the contracts between the two parties, between the pharmacy benefit manager and the pharmacies, covers much of this. So when a PBM contracts with a pharmacy, it covers all types of issues. It covers, for example, the notice requirements that are in the first two subsections. We don't have a problem with those notice requirements, but they're unnecessary because they're covered in the contracts with the parties. But we do take particular issue with several of the requirements. Subparagraph 3 requires the audit of a claim occur within 2 years, yet Medicare and Medicaid require or allow for 10 years. Subparagraph 4 is vague. It's not well written, and I'm not even really sure what problem they're attempting to address. Subparagraph 5 is vague and not well written. Who decides the standards and perimeters? What is the definition of a similarly situated pharmacy? The contracts between the PBM and the pharmacy already cover the auditing standards. Subparagraph 6 is the most objectionable in the proposed law. One of the major benefits of an audit is for a consumer to find fraud. For example, if a pharmacy is committing fraud by marking up prescriptions by $1, all their prescriptions, this subparagraph could hinder the auditor's authority to name it what it is, which is fraud. Subparagraph 7 is vague and not well defined. Subparagraph 8 is objectionable. There are several parties involved in the prescription benefit plan, including the member, the fund, the consultant, the attorney, the pharmacy benefit manager, the pharmacy, and there are already confidentiality agreements in place between all those parties, and so these reports wouldn't get distributed anyway. Subparagraph 9 and 10 are objectionable. Extrapolation is used in most audits, and I'm not talking about just pharmacy audits, but all audits. When you have volume of anything, including claims, it's not possible to audit every claim. So extrapolation is a reasonable method to determine the amount the pharmacy should pay if errors are found. Extrapolation is used in all forms of audits, and if the error rate is high, the auditor will continue to expand the sample until they establish a pattern. And so it's a very reliable way to determine what the party, you know, what the findings are. This is clearly, I mean, subparagraph 9 and 10, it's clearly an attempt for the pharmacies to limit their financial exposure, which is unfair to those who are paying the claims. Subparagraph 11 doesn't make sense. Dispensing fees are not the only revenue the pharmacy receives. They also make money on the drugs, and there's a lot of revenue built into the dispensing fee. It really isn't just what the pharmacy gets paid. And it is part of the overall claim. We're paying the dispensing fee as well as the drug fee and all that stuff. Subparagraph 12 is unnecessary. This is covered in the contracts with the pharmacy, and they generally allow for 90 days. Subparagraph 13 is interesting. In the prior paragraph, the auditor must deliver the audit within 60 days. That's, quote, within 60 days, end quote. And in this paragraph, subparagraph 13, the pharmacy has, quote, at least 30 days to respond, end quote. Clearly, it's tilted in favor of the pharmacies and not the consumer. Subparagraph 14 is vague and could only create problems and costs for the state who will be expected to administer such provision. Subparagraph 15 is confusing. Doesn't a final appeal come after a final audit report? 14 and 15 appear to create a kind of an unending cycle where you could be going back and forth from the audit to the final report to the appeal. Subparagraph 16 is unnecessary. This is covered in the contract between the parties. Again, dispensing fees should not be excluded from the final analysis of an audited claim. Subparagraph 17 is objectionable. How we pay our auditors should not be something the pharmacy dictates. The pharmacies do not pay for these audits, plans like ours do, and that's the members' money. And there are many different ways in which auditors may be paid. Restricting the consumer's freedom to contract with auditors on their own terms is objectionable. Subparagraph 18 is objectionable. We have, if we have overpaid a pharmacy, why would they get the use of our revenue without refunding us plus the interest? And we have no objection with paragraph 19. And that's the end of my testimony.
You're sure.
Rose, my ears perked up about halfway through. Do you get a fee or a rebate back from PBM based on the audits?
We get not from the PBM, but from the manufacturers. There are rebates.
Oh, okay. Who's got the next question? Yep, you got off light, Rose. Going once?
Boy, I guess.
Representative Sadler, okay. Going twice?
Okay, I'll bite.
You'll bite?
It's not the best foreign question. I'm sorry. Miss, you talked on your objection to subparagraph 11. You said unfair to those paying claim. I'm sorry, I think I'm probably about two beats behind you. Can you explain where paying a claim comes into this process? A claim is, I just lost my track as to who's paying a claim for what to whom.
Oh, okay. The plan, which is a self-funded plan, so the Alaska Teamster plan is self-funded. We're not insured. The money that pays for all these claims is a direct result of the bargaining between the union and the employers who employ these members. So really it's the members' money because it's all part of their wage package, what they get paid and what goes to pay for their medical bills and pharmacy benefits, et cetera. And so when we contract with the PBM, they're simply an agency that controls our pharmacy costs. So a member gets a prescription, they go into the pharmacy, they put it in, and the pharmacy has a contract with that PBM too. So the member goes in with their prescription drug card and it says that, you know, that the Teamster member has a health trans PBM. So then the pharmacy runs it through that computer program and it says, and then the computer screen will say, okay, for this drug, the pharmacy benefit manager will pay X amount, the member will pay X amount. And so right there the transaction takes place. Now, at the end of the day, we pay the pharmacy benefit manager for all the money that's from us through the pharmacy benefit manager to all the various pharmacies.
I think we're representing Sadler's getting hung up as claim and benefit. It's a claim when it's made against the plan, but it's a benefit going back to the covered employee.
Right, right.
Thanks again. Yeah. Dirk White, Sitka, are you with us?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and please state your name and affiliation. I've got a feeling you've probably got a slightly different perspective.
Just a bit. This is Dirk White. I'm a pharmacist from Sitka, Alaska, and I'm on the Board of Pharmacy. And I'd like to thank you, Chairman, and the members for hearing this today. The Board of Pharmacy, you should have a letter in your packet supporting this bill today. And, of course, we, as pharmacists and as the Board of Pharmacy, have no problem with anybody auditing for fraud or abuse. If that is out there, obviously we want that stopped. But when a prescription is legal, valid, and it's filled according to the state and federal statutes and regs, it should be allowed to stand as unrecuperable or unrecoverable. Audits can be very costly for a pharmacy to absorb those costs and expense and may end up reducing access to the primary care in that a community pharmacy provides if they're forced to close. Now, right now, we're looking at ourselves personally, a couple of audits that are going to total about $7,000 for two wheelchairs. We may close that part of our business down because we just can't afford to suffer those kind of losses. We provided those chairs to the patients. The patients enjoyed the use of those chairs. They worked well for them. They improved their quality. Now, if we can't produce a certain piece of paper for the auditors, they'll say, well, you have to pay us the money back. And there's no fraud. There's no misuse. If there's a civil suit, obviously you're going to see fraud show up or abuse or a problem. Those complaints come to the pharmacy board, and we would review those. Outside of federal regulations, I really see no need for audits. I guess I would have one quick question or a comment on it's been made numerous times that, oh, we're able to negotiate different things in our contracts. I've never, ever gotten a returned contract that I've modified in the least. If I line out something I don't like in a contract, it never comes back. When I call people about it, there's no negotiation on it whatsoever. The contracts are take it or leave it, and we don't have any ability to really negotiate. Another one that was mentioned was that dispensing fees cover the costs. Well, I just looked at it, opened a contract today that had a dispensing fee of $1. And when the state did a cost to dispense survey 3 years ago, the Alaska Medicaid Department did, that cost to dispense survey said our dispensing fees should range anywhere from $11 to $27 in the rural area. And there's no insurance company or PBM that's paying that kind of dispensing fee. So I just like to say please support House Bill 259, and I open myself up to questions. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thanks again, and we've got time for one more. Jolie McDonald, are you with us?
Hello?
Hi, Jolie?
Yes.
Oh.
Hi. Thank you for my phone kind of beeped out right when you said my name. Thank you for hearing me. My name is Julie. I am on the board of the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I am calling today on behalf of independent rural pharmacists. In 2008, I first became a pharmacist, and I thought audits were going to be great, you know, limit fraud and abuse, we're all for that. However, I have since come to the opinion that these audits are nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to recruit revenue back to the insurance company. An example would be a patient gets it named Ann, A-N-N-E, gets a prescription. The prescriber writes the name as A-N-N. Even though the last name's on there, the date of birth, the address, it's very clear you have the correct patient. An auditor will come through and say, oh, the doctor didn't write an E in the name. That's the wrong name. We're going to now require repayment for the original fill as well as every subsequent refill on the prescription. So that's just one example. I have seen at independent pharmacies be billed for up to $12,000 on audits. So rather than give a lot of examples, I just wanted to briefly describe six trends that I've seen with audits that that kind of caught my attention. The first is the selection of high-cost prescriptions to audit. You would think the focus would be on prescriptions that have high error rates or maybe those that are frequently abused, but it is most commonly, if not exclusively, high-cost medications. Secondly, auditors consistently seem to arrive at the busiest times for the pharmacy, like on Mondays, like the first week of the month, which leads to point three. The audits greatly disrupt the pharmacists from providing patient care and very much unsettle the normal workflow of the pharmacy. Number four, the auditors use extrapolation to calculate overpayment, which in my opinion results in grossly exaggerated figures. Number five, auditors will ask for documentation that's not required by state or federal law and has not previously been requested by insurance company. For example, we had a patient that needed vacation supply. The pharmacist called the doctor and the insurance company for approval before filling the prescription early. Pharmacist noted on the prescription those phone calls and that it was filled early for vacation supply. Then, it was more than a year later, the auditor came in and wanted to know why a specific code, like 02, wasn't written on the back of the prescription. The pharmacist stood there dumbfounded, having no idea what this code was or why that would be required, and the auditor requested required repayment for that claim. I would say the most, number six, and the most troubling of all, is the pharmacy is handed this bill at the end and aren't left a means to adequately appeal the audit. Now, this is especially true for your small mom-and-pop pharmacies that don't have legal departments and other such resources available to them. In closing, I would like to make one other key point. Sometimes these audits are done by insurance companies or PBMs that is owned by a chain drugstore. Therefore, if you're a small pharmacy, you're essentially being audited by your much larger competitor. I have nothing against chains. I've worked for them. Many of my friends work for them. Mm-hmm. However, let's take another example. If you had Burger King and allowed it to, in an unregulated manner, inspect, let's say Bob's hamburger shop, mm-hmm. that might present quite a problem for Bob. In any case, I really appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this issue and your willingness to consider it.
Any questions for Julie?
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Briefly restate your fourth trend, number four. I just missed that.
My point number four was that the extrapolation and about how that relates to these exaggerated figures, that practice.
I didn't get that.
I didn't hear it. Please get close to the mic and speak slowly for the old guy.
Old guys.
I'm a little nervous. I talk quickly when I'm nervous. Number four is the practice of extrapolation and how that leads to over-exaggerated figures.
Got it. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thanks again for joining us, and we're going to hold the public testimony open. We've still got several more people, and it's after 5 o'clock. We're adjourning at 5:02.